what he always did on Earth. He prayed. He gave thanks that he and Scott were here, that everything was working so well. He did not think of his family now or of events at home. He would say later that he had divorced the Earth. He prayed for the success of the mission they were about to begin. Then Irwin fell into a sound sleep, his best sleep of the whole flight. Saturday, July 31st, 8:29 a.m., Houston time, 4 days, 23 hours, 55 minutes, mission elapsed time. If Dave Scott's heart pounded as he hopped down Falcon's ladder, it was not really at the thought of becoming the seventh man to walk on the moon. He would say years later that he had already accepted being here. His elation as a newly minted lunar field geologist was at arriving at the best field site he could have imagined. As he took his first steps at Hadley Base, his words, composed with history in mind, were a preamble for what he and Irwin were about to do. Man must explore, and this is exploration at its greatest. The key to that exploration, Lunar Rover 1, was folded up against Falcon's side like a toy in a matchbox. Within minutes, Irwin had joined Scott, and the two men set about bringing the rover to the surface. They pulled on a pair of lanyards, and the chassis lowered slowly like a drawbridge. Suddenly, wheels of wire mesh with orange fenders popped out from the corners with a bit more pulling, interrupted when Irwin slipped and tumbled, laughing onto the soft powder. The first manned motorized vehicle was on the moon. 9:22 a.m. It would have been a strange sight, had anyone been there to witness it, a four-wheeled craft heading out among the craters bearing two space-suited men. The rover was less a car than a spacecraft on wheels, with its own navigation computer, communication system, and cargo space for such essentials as maps, geology tools, and moon rocks. For all its sophisticated technology, there was still a hobby shop look to this moon car, with its antennas and folding lawn chair seats and tool racks. It had been designed, built, and tested by Boeing in less than 2 years. The success of the mission rode on it. Aboard Rover 1, the ride was more exciting than anyone, including Scott and Irwin, had banked on. Though the rover averaged only 5 to 7 miles an hour, it seemed more than fast enough to the two men perched atop it. Every time the rover hit a bump, and the plane at Hadley was all bumps and hollows, it took flight. Each new obstacle set one or two wheels off the ground for a long moment. As an added encumbrance, the steering on the rover's front wheels was inexplicably out of commission, forcing Scott to rely on the rear wheel steering alone. The ride was especially harrowing for Jim Irwin, who felt as though he were strapped onto a bucking bronco, especially when Scott had to swerve to avoid a crater. The transmissions from the rover were punctuated every so often with a warning from Scott, "Hang on," followed by Irwin's grin and Barrett laughter. Scott and Irwin were having as much trouble gauging distance on the airless, treeless moon as everyone had before them, but they were in no danger of losing their way, thanks to the rover's navigation system. It clicked off readings of heading and distance as Scott drove. Irwin, meanwhile, followed along on the photo map. Aside from the usual difficulty in recognizing landmarks, the maps were misleading. Many of the craters and bumps that looked so prominent on the over-enhanced photos were barely noticeable on the real moon. But one landmark was impossible to miss, and as the rover headed southwest, over the undulating mare, both men suddenly caught sight of it. "There's the rill!" For a time they followed the canyon's curving edge, then stopped at Elbow Crater to gather samples. Soon they were driving again, heading uphill toward St. George. Scott could feel the difference. 11:10 a.m. "Oh, look back there, Jim. Look at that. We're up on a slope, Joe, and we're looking down into the valley, and that is spectacular." Standing beside the rover, Scott and Irwin looked down the mountainside and saw Hadley Rill winding into the distance, its walls curving through shadows and sunlight. They could see boulders the size of houses strewn on the valley floor. Even as he and Irwin set to work, Scott was still reacting to the sight. It was ironic. He'd studied this place so thoroughly he almost felt he knew it in advance. He'd even driven over it in simulations. He looked forward to the work he was about to do. But there was one thing about Hadley he had never anticipated. Its spectacular beauty. 11:18 a.m., Science Operations Room, Manned Spacecraft Center. We have a view of the rill that is absolutely unearthly. Even as Joe Allen's voice sped moonward, it was heard by a roomful of exhilarated geologists in a small command center across the hall from Mission Control. Here in the Science Operations Room, otherwise known as the Geology Back Room, all eyes were riveted to the television monitors suspended from the ceiling. The color pictures were the sharpest ever transmitted from the moon. Lee Silver felt an excitement that was hard to describe. This was not vicarious pleasure. In essence, he was a participant. He had given some thought, years ago, to the astronaut program, but had decided against it. For one thing, he was almost too old to apply. For another, he knew that, ironically, the total commitment necessary to go to the moon would likely rob him of the opportunity to study the rocks he brought back. Now he and the other geologists were here. Not as spectators to thrill vicariously to their students' adventure, but to participate in the exploration itself. All morning, Gordon Swan and his surface geology team had followed the unfolding moonwalk with the precision of battlefield commanders. One man, wearing headphones, took notes on index cards, jotting down every rock collected, every picture taken, every comment pertaining to geology. Another listened to the astronauts' descriptions and made annotated sketches, which were then thrown onto the wall by an overhead projector. Another marked down the astronauts' positions on a map that was projected onto another wall, and along the walls were panoramic views of Hadley Base captured in Polaroid pictures taken from the television monitors. Presiding over this group was another familiar face, Jim Lovell, who had taken charge of the geology back room at Dave Scott's request. But there was another presence in the back room, and it was a reminder of discord. How to collect rocks on the moon had been a matter of heated debate within the scientific community. To the geochemists, a rock's context wasn't important. All that mattered was getting it back to their laboratories. The geochemists would have been happy to have the astronauts simply fill up a gunny sack with as many rocks as possible. Some even opposed giving them any geology training at all, afraid that the astronauts would go to the moon with the preconceptions of their instructors. On the eve of the mission, they had warned the geologists in no uncertain terms that they better not have biased Scott and Irwin. Now one of them sat in the back room, watching Silver and the rest of the geology team. Silver had never been able to convince these scientists what he and the others were trying to do with Scott and Irwin. This was not an exercise in programming, but in learning. When Silver showed them anorthosite in the San Gabriels, he made a point of saying that no one knew what the moon's primordial crust was made of. No one knew what they'd find, and the astronauts understood that. Just now, the rover's television camera was panning under remote control to show Scott and Irwin at work. There was Dave Scott, standing near a dark, sharp-edged boulder about knee-high. Scott stood back, describing it before he disturbed it. Silver knew that Scott knew the importance of finding large boulders. Never before had the geologists had the luxury of knowing exactly where a sample had come from. This rock was big enough. It had probably been just where it was for a long time. Scott and Irwin were in the process of scooping up some of the dust around the rock. There was glass splattered on top of the rock. Scott managed to pull some of it off. Then Scott drew his hammer and prepared to knock a piece off the boulder. He told Allen, "You know what we're going to do when we get through with this thing, Joe? We're going to roll it over and sample the soil beneath." That sample, which had been shielded from the effects of solar and cosmic radiation, would let the scientists determine how long the rock had been sitting there. And once he and Irwin had hammered off pieces of the boulder, which turned out to be composed of two different types of rock, Scott did just that. In this one stop, he and Irwin gathered samples that would meet the requirements of several different groups of lunar scientists. Scott had recognized the optimum collecting site on his own. None of the geochemists, Silver knew, could have prepared him to do that. And when he pushed over that boulder, he felled many of the unspoken doubts that had hung over the back room. As Scott and Irwin headed back to Falcon, the geology team was on a high that would continue long after this first moonwalk was over. History would record that in the evening, Dale Jackson of the USGS dined with Joe Allen, Dick Gordon, and several friends at a restaurant called Eric's Crown and Anchor, near the Space Center. Jackson made no attempt to contain his enthusiasm for Scott and Irwin's performance on the moon. "Did you see those guys today? They got up there on the side of that mountain and found that boulder." His booming voice filled the room. "And they sampled the soil around the rock, and then they knocked a piece off it, and then they rolled it over and got some of the soil underneath it." By this time, people at the next tables had turned around to look. Everyone heard Jackson proclaim, "Why, they did everything but fuck that rock!" 12:33 p.m. Houston time, Hadley Base. The sweet taste of fruit, a cool swig of water, sustenance for a long day's work. The fruit stick and the water bag inside Scott's suit was a reflection of the fact that no one had ever been at work in a spacesuit for so long. He and Irwin sorely needed the boost because now, 4 hours after setting foot on the moon, they returned to Falcon to unload their all-set package and deploy it on the rolling plains. But before the work could even begin, Allen had some bad news. For reasons that would never be known, Scott's oxygen usage had been higher than expected, in part because of the demands of steering Rover 1 safely among the craters. The moonwalk would probably have to end early. But for Scott, the hardest work of the day was still ahead. Apollo 15's ALSEP had a new experiment, a pair of thermometers designed to measure the amount of heat flowing from the interior. Scott's task was to bore a pair of 10-foot holes using a battery-powered drill, then insert the sensors. While Irwin set up other instruments, Scott activated the small, box-like machine that had a handle on either side and a long tube extending from the bottom. Drilling proved to be an unexpected struggle. Shy of the 10 feet requested for the heat flow probes, the drill met resistance and would go no further. The drill took its toll on Scott. Despite their greater freedom of movement, the new suits had one real weakness, the gloves. No one had been able to develop a pressure glove that was easy to operate. At rest, the glove assumed a position that was half opened, half closed. In order to grip an object like a hammer or a pair of tongs, you had to exert constant pressure to keep the glove closed around it. After a few hours of this, the forearms ached, but even worse was the damage it did to the fingers. Before the mission, in the interest of having as much dexterity as possible, Scott and Irwin had arranged to have the arms of their spacesuits shortened so that their fingers were right against the tips of the gloves. When they extended their arms or brought them in close, the rubber tips pressed against their fingernails. At first, it was just a minor discomfort. After a while, it felt like someone had hit their fingers with a hammer, but for the most part, Scott's excitement eclipsed his pain. And as this first excursion came to an end after some 6 hours, too short in Scott's mind, he stole a last chance to pick up samples. "Oh, look at what I got," he called to Irwin, who was already back in the lander. And then, treasure in hand, he ascended Falcon's ladder, a geologist in a remote and spectacular place, returning to the comfort of his field tent. 2. High Point. Sunday, August 1st, 1971, Hadley Base. The mountains of the moon captivated Jim Irwin just as he knew they would. That anticipation had been with him yesterday as he followed Scott down Falcon's ladder. When he put his weight on the footpad, it tipped so suddenly that he went reeling backward, hanging on with one hand, until he was gazing almost straight up at the sparkling blue world he had left behind. Regaining his balance, he took his first buoyant steps into the valley and could not suppress his elation. The Apennines were not gray or brown, as he had expected, but golden in the light of lunar morning. Their rounded, dust-covered forms reminded him of ski slopes, Dollar and Half-Dollar Mountains at Sun Valley. He was surprised to find that a place others had called stark and desolate could feel so friendly. The mountains surrounded Hadley Base like a cradling hand. He felt at home on the moon. But yesterday's exploration had taken a toll on Irwin. Not until he and Scott were back in the LM did Irwin feel the full measure of his exhaustion. Aside from the mental fatigue brought on by the hours of intense concentration, and the pressure of finally doing the real thing instead of just simulating it, he was physically spent. The incessant glare from the sun and the bright landscape had given him a fierce headache, and he was parched. The water bag in his suit had refused to work, and he'd gone more than 7 hours without a drink. Worst of all was the pain in his fingers. By the end of the moonwalk, they were so sore that when it came time to take off his gloves, he had to ask Scott for help. When they had settled in for the evening, Irwin used a pair of scissors to trim his fingernails all the way back. That helped. He suggested his commander do the same, but Scott declined, reluctant to do anything that might compromise his dexterity. After the moonwalk, Irwin had been overtired, and he had not slept well. Then this morning, he and Scott were awakened early by a call from Mission Control to check on a water leak in Falcon's cabin. When they looked behind the ascent engine cover, they found a couple of gallons of water that had leaked through a broken filter. Irwin was glad that Grumman had waterproofed the LM's electronics. Thankfully, despite all of this, Irwin felt renewed as he and Scott prepared for the second traverse. Yesterday they'd been denied the chance for real prospecting up on Hadley Delta. Now they would have one more chance to find out what the mountains of the moon had to offer. 8:07 a.m. Houston time, 5 days, 23 hours, 33 minutes mission elapsed time, science operations room. Rover 1 did its drunken gallop across the Mare, heading south, and in the science back room, Lee Silver listened to Scott and Irwin's progress. As usual, Scott was going full throttle and they were making good time. They zipped past Dune Crater, a yawning, block-rimmed hole in the Mare that was their last landmark before Hadley Delta. Then they reported they were going up a slight incline. They were on the flank of the mountain. With Scott concentrating on his driving, Irwin was doing most of the talking, and Silver was glad for what he heard. Only a few days before launch, after the last of a regular series of evening geology briefings at the Cape, Silver had said goodbye to his students. In the parking lot of the crew quarters, he wished them well. He felt admiration for them, and also concern, but they radiated confidence. He turned to Irwin. Though Irwin was just as adept as Scott, Silver knew, he usually deferred to his commander and said comparatively little. One day late in the training, he'd taken Irwin aside and said, "Talk to me up there, Jim. Don't just follow Dave around." Now, saying his goodbye, Silver offered one more smiling admonition. "Now, Jim, we're going to hear from you up there, right?" Irwin smiled back. "You bet." Silver needn't have worried. Irwin was full of detailed, precise descriptions as the rover bounced along. He brought a patient thoroughness to the explorations that complemented Scott's drive and exuberance. He frequently directed his commander's attention to something too important to ignore, but always as a suggestion. "Dave, shouldn't we get that rock over there?" And now, as Silver listened, Irwin made a new discovery. The side of Mount Hadley was covered with a slanting pattern of straight lines, as if a giant comb had been dragged across it. Everyone in the back room wondered excitedly whether the lines might help solve the riddle of how these mountains had formed. Perhaps Mount Hadley was a block of layered bedrock that had been raised up by the violence of the Imbrium impact. For more clues, they would have to wait for the photographs. And when Irwin brought Scott's attention to the new find, "Oh, yeah," Scott said, Silver found himself smiling. 8:28 a.m. The rover climbed effortlessly. Even now, heading directly up the slope, it was making 6 miles per hour. The plan was to work their way along the mountainside, sampling whatever geologic variety Hadley Delta had to offer. Scott knew what the geologists wanted. A crater that had acted as drill hole into the mountain, strewn with boulders torn from the flank. But there were no such craters in sight. There was a sameness to the terrain up here. Everything was much more worn and subtle than the photographs had led them to believe. Angling along the contour of the mountain, Scott searched for a target, finally spotting a medium-sized crater. There weren't any boulders, but it would have to do. When he hopped off the rover, he almost fell over backward. The drive had been so easy that he had no idea the steepness of the slope they were on. Glancing at his feet, he saw to his surprise that his boots were half buried in dust, and yet the wire mesh wheels of the rover, fully loaded with both of them in spacesuits, had penetrated only a fraction of an inch. He warned Irwin to be careful. Then he turned around, and what he saw almost knocked him off balance again. They were more than 300 feet up. Hadley Delta's broad flank swept downward and merged with a bright, undulating desert adorned with the brilliant white rims of craters. Beyond, the Apennines invaded the dome of space. The entire valley was one enormous, incredibly clear panorama. It was the face of pure nature, and out in the middle of this pristine wilderness, a single artifact, his lunar module. Falcon, that big metal and foil bird, was a mere speck. No scene could have conveyed more vividly the reach of this exploration, or the risk. If something had happened to the rover now, Scott and Irwin would have faced a long and difficult walk to safety, for the LM was more than 3 miles away, much more than the distance covered by Shepard and Mitchell during their round trip to Cone Crater. The whole question of how far to let two rover-riding astronauts go had consumed hours of pre-mission deliberation. At no time could the men be allowed to drive farther than they could walk back with the amount of oxygen remaining in their backpacks. Because their oxygen supply dwindled as the moonwalk progressed, this walk-back limit would be an ever-tightening circle. Even if the rover worked flawlessly, and so far it had done nearly that, there was always the chance that a backpack would fail. In that case, the men would break out a set of hoses that would allow them to share cooling water. The man with the failed backpack would survive on his own emergency pack, which contained about an hour's worth of oxygen, and if necessary, his partner's emergency pack, allowing more than enough time for the rover to race back to the lander. A more dire scenario was that both the rover and a backpack might break down. For a time, this remote possibility had so worried the managers that they considered writing the mission rules around it, a change that would have severely limited Scott and Irwin's explorations. In the end, NASA bought the risk of the double failure, knowing that if it came to pass, one of the astronauts would not make it back to the lander alive. But all of this was far from Scott's mind as his gaze lingered on the view. He felt a wave of excitement. Everything was working. He joined Irwin, and the two men headed down the slope to the crater. The mountain was a difficult workplace. The stiffness of their suits hindered climbing. They were reduced to taking small, ineffective hops. With every step, the soft, thick dust fell away from their feet, as if they were walking on the side of a sand dune. A few steps left them nearly out of breath. They spent the better part of an hour here, winning only a few samples for their efforts. There just wasn't the variety they'd hoped for. They would make another try at Spur Crater, but first Scott wanted to get to a boulder they'd spotted along the way. "Man, I'd sure hate to have to climb up here," said an amazed Scott as he struggled back up the slope, grateful that the rover had done so well. "You'd never get here without this thing." And yet they had barely begun to scale Hadley Delta. With no haze to block the view, its upper reaches were clearly visible, many thousands of feet beyond. Gazing on that bright frontier, Irwin silently wished they could go higher. 9:38 a.m., Mission Operations Control Room. Joe Allen sat at the Capcom's console, studying a photo map of Hadley Delta. Every so often he made a mark showing the best estimate of where the rover was. His brown hair, short on the sides but longer in front, fell across an unlined forehead. Allen listened intently to the voices of his friends on the moon. At the same time, he kept an ear tuned to the conversations in the geology back room. He also had a TV monitor on which the scientists could write him notes. "We'd like a core tube at this stop." So that if a question came down from the moon, Allen would be ready with the answer. And it was Allen's job to take the myriad inputs to the astronauts, from the geologists, the flight director, and the flight controllers, and synthesize them into one coherent voice. Joseph Percival Allen IV, an Iowa-born physicist who came to NASA with the XS-11, was sometimes known as Little Joe, because at 5'6" he had usurped Pete Conrad by 1/2 inch as the shortest man in the astronaut office. At 34, he looked as young as the day he entered Yale to begin working toward his doctorate. In the minds of the geologists, Allen's assignment as mission scientist was one of the best things that happened to Apollo 15. Allen combined a youthful enthusiasm with a keen scientific mind and an innate sense of people. On the field trips, it was Allen who took the edge off Scott's driving intensity with a humorous remark. Now, as Capcom, Joe Allen was Scott and Irwin's link with the back room. No one but he could speak directly to Scott and Irwin. Any requests, advice, or questions from the back room had to be spoken by Lovell over the loop to Flight Director Jerry Griffin and then, via Allen, to the moon. It was no accident that every link in this human chain had been out on the field trips at one time or another, and that each understood the scientific objectives of the mission. Allen, in particular, understood so well that often he did not even need to ask the back room what to say. He was more than just an ally, Lee Silver would say years later. He was a colleague. Throughout the moonwalks, Allen had tried to convey a sense of support and optimism. He knew Scott and Irwin were working very hard, and he never missed an opportunity to ease the pressure with a comic remark, a private joke. At each new achievement, however minor, Allen voiced his approval. Extraordinary. Superb. Deke Slayton had come down on him once or twice for deviating from the spare style of communication that characterized standard pilots' radio discipline. Allen didn't let that bother him. There wasn't any operational reason not to let Scott and Irwin know that he was pulling for them. He knew roughly where Scott and Irwin were, a few hundred meters east of Spur Crater, and slightly upslope from it. Scott had already radioed that he didn't think it was worth going any farther to the east. They had already seen as much variety as they were likely to see. They had stopped to sample a lone boulder that was apparently too good to pass up. Allen listened intently as Scott maneuvered the rover, then stopped. Suddenly the radio link was scratchy, but through the static, Allen could hear Scott's labored breathing. He heard Irwin say, "Gonna be a bear to get back up here, you know." "Hey, troops," Allen said with contained urgency, "I'm not sure you should go downslope very far, if at all, from the rover." "No, it's not that far," came Scott's answer. Irwin added gamely, "I think we can sidestep back up." There was no television from the rover just now, but Allen could picture the steep, powdery slope. He also knew Scott and Irwin wouldn't give up a prize without a fight, and he could sense that the managers in the back row of Mission Control were getting worried. Suddenly Scott called out that the rover was beginning to slide down the hill. "The back wheel's off the ground," said Irwin. Their voices didn't convey the seriousness of the situation. If the rover got away from them, it meant scrapping much of the mission, and a long walk back to the LM. Allen listened as Scott held onto the rover to keep it from sliding down the hill. Now he heard Irwin talking about something he'd noticed on top of the boulder, some kind of green material, he was saying. Allen knew that was unusual, and he wasn't surprised when Irwin urged Scott to get a sample. The men traded places. Now Irwin held the rover while Scott made his way to the boulder. "Use your best judgment here," Allen cautioned once more, sensing now that Scott and Irwin had the situation under control. Within minutes, having bagged a piece of their strange find, the men were driving again, heading west towards Spur Crater. Time was running out. This would be the last stop on the mountain. 10 a.m. Heading downslope once more, Scott and Irwin angled toward Spur Crater and stopped next to the rim of the football field-sized pit. Spur looked promising. There weren't many big rocks, but there was great variety in the small fragments that littered the soil. Immediately, Irwin noticed a white rock, perched atop a small, light gray pinnacle that was different from anything he'd seen. Irwin wanted to rush over to it, but Scott was already collecting another rock. Even as Irwin went to help him, he spotted something even more curious. It was more of that green material, like the coating on the boulder at the last stop. What could it be? Moon rocks were gray, or they were tan or black or white, but not sparkling light green. To Irwin, a man of Irish descent who was born on St. Patrick's Day and had shamrocks tucked away in the lunar module, a green rock was a special find. There was some debate about whether the color was real. Scott thought their gold-plated visors were playing tricks on them, but they picked it up anyway. It looked like a chunk of basalt, shot through with tiny holes where gas bubbles once frothed in molten lava. But it couldn't be basalt. It actually yielded to the pressure of Scott's gloved fingers, which left streaks in its surface. Not until the rock was unpacked in the lunar receiving laboratory would the men see that it truly was green, and that it was actually made of tiny spheres of glass. Even among moon rocks, it was a rarity, and in time, the story it would tell of eruptions from the hidden depths of the lunar interior would hold geologists spellbound. But just now, Scott and Irwin's attention was riveted to the strange white rock Irwin had seen earlier. As they approached, they strategized about the best way to collect it. Irwin suggested lifting it off its dusty pedestal with the tongs. Scott did so, and he raised it to his faceplate to inspect the find, which was about the size of his fist. It looked fairly beaten up, and it was covered with dust, but as he grasped it with his gloved fingers, some of the ancient coating wiped off, and he could see crystals, large white crystals. Suddenly,
"Ah! Oh, man!"
Both men realized what they had discovered. The rock was almost entirely plagioclase, exposed to light for the first time in untold eons. Its white crystals glinted in the sun, like the ones they had seen in the San Gabriels. This was surely a chunk of anorthosite, a piece of the primordial crust. Scott radioed the news. "Guess what we just found? Guess what we just found? I think we found what we came for." "Crystalline rock, huh?" prompted Irwin.
"Yes, sir," said Scott.
"Yes, sir," repeated Joe Allen, like a brother at a revival meeting. After describing the rock in detail, Scott placed it in a special sample bag by itself. Of all the rocks brought back from the moon, this one would be the most famous. To the geologists, it would be sample number 15415. But to the world, it would be known by the name bestowed upon it by a reporter covering the mission at the Space Center, the Genesis Rock. In time, probing the treasure with electron beams in their laboratories, the geologists would peg the rock's age at 4.5 billion years. If the moon was any older than that, it wasn't much older. The solar system itself was thought to have formed only 100 million years earlier. Scott couldn't hear the geologists' ecstatic reactions in the back room, but he didn't need to. And Spur had even more to offer. As they made their way along the crater rim, they happened on one remarkable find after another, poking out of the dust. Scott sounded like a rare coin collector who had stumbled across a treasure chest in the attic.
"Oh, look at this one," Scott told Alan what was already clear.
"Joe, this crater is a gold mine."
"And there might be diamonds in the next one," said Alan, a gentle reminder that Scott and Irwin could not linger here. They were getting close enough to their immutable walk-back limit that Alan was telling them to press on. Now Alan radioed that Irwin's sample bag was about to come loose. Everyone in Mission Control could see that on the big screen, and they worried that all those priceless samples might tumble into Spur Crater. Precious minutes were lost as Scott cinched it up. With less than 15 minutes remaining, Scott and Irwin looked hopefully at a boulder that lay perhaps a dozen yards farther along Spur's rim, the only large rock in sight, and therefore the only rock for which the geologists could be sure of its place of origin. Undoubtedly, it had been torn from the floor of Spur. Just now, Alan passed up word from the back room. Forget the boulder. They wanted them back at the rover, using the rake to collect a bunch of walnut-sized fragments. Scott eyed the boulder. He told Irwin to go ahead and start raking. In the meantime, he went into high gear. A short run along Spur's rim brought him to his quarry. Working on stolen time, he clicked off Hasselblad pictures of it from every angle. There wasn't time to hammer off a piece, but he spotted a small fragment in the dust, obviously knocked loose from the big rock, and got his sample after all. He hoped the geologists would be able to figure out where it came from by studying the pictures. Scott turned and ran back to join Irwin in his work. He hated to leave. It was a frustration he would feel again and again on the moon. Just as he had that first day in the Aracopias with Silver, there was never enough time. 12:41 p.m. Heading back to the LM, Irwin was glad to be traveling on more level ground.
Up on the mountain, there had been times, driving along the contour of the steep slope, when Irwin was afraid the rover would tip over. Now, pulled away from their explorations by the pressures of time and timeline, he and Scott made a brief stop at the LM, then revisited their all-set package. That tiny city of instruments sprawled in the dust. Scott had to summon more strength from his sore, tired hands to drill into the soil for the so-called deep core sample. While Scott drilled, Irwin dug a trench in the gray dust, took pictures of it, and used a device called a penetrometer to test the bearing strength of the trench walls and bottom. Irwin's tests would reveal much about the mechanical properties of lunar soil. Scott's fingers were already so badly injured that they were beginning to turn black, and they were sore from cinching up sample bags all morning. Using the drill just made them worse. He had to bring his hands in close to his chest in order to squeeze the drill's trigger, and he could stand only a minute or so of the pressure against his nails before he had to back off, shaking his arms against the pain. But he kept at it. Now one core tube was in. Then he added a second. He could feel the drill meet resistance, then penetrate more easily again. Soon he had drilled the full 10 feet down. It was the deepest lunar core sample ever. Inside were millions of years' worth of lunar history. Now he tried to pull the core out of the ground, but it wouldn't come. When Joe Allen told him to leave it until tomorrow, he was disappointed. Still, it was getting to be a long day, and he could feel it. By the time he and Irwin climbed back inside Falcon, they had been outside for more than 7 hours. Today alone they had driven almost 8 miles, and they had been rewarded for their hard work. It was a day in the field any geologist would have been proud of. The secret of living on the moon, in Dave Scott's mind, came down to one thing, getting out of his suit. He and Irwin would have been miserable if they'd been sentenced to 3 full days inside them. By now the whole process was routine. Off came the gloves, then the helmets, and then, one at a time, each man stepped into a white stowage bag and pulled it up over his legs to catch the rain of soot and stripped to his long johns. Piled in the back of the cabin, the suits would dry out from almost 9 hours' worth of wear. Then came the chores, recharging the backpacks with oxygen and water, stowing the rocks they had collected that day, and attending to Falcon's systems. And there was another routine that wasn't in the flight plan. Each day, Scott and Irwin paused in their work for a brief chat with their orbiting companion. The signal was broken up until Worden cleared the mountains, but then there was time to exchange news and pleasantries as Endeavour sped, star-like, overhead. Scott was glad to hear that Worden and his arsenal of scientific instruments were going like gangbusters, and then, before Endeavour drifted out of range, more mundane matters. "Hey, Al," called Irwin. "Throw my soap down, will you? And my spoon?" "You forget something, Jim?" Irwin grinned through lunar grime. "I really need my soap." Aboard Endeavour, everything was still quite clean and neat, except perhaps Al Worden, who had at this point gone a week without a shower or a shave and was happy to have Irwin's soap aboard. Like his friends at Hadley Base, Al Worden was too busy to care how grungy he was. He was, in effect, the commander of the first fully equipped orbiting lunar science platform. Endeavour's service module was crammed to the hilt with high-powered cameras and sensors, and much of Worden's time was spent turning the instruments on and off as dictated by the flight plan. 2 different sensors were designed to map the chemical composition of the surface. Another would try to detect evidence for volcanic gases seeping out of the moon during recent geologic time. A mass spectrometer was included to sniff out extremely tenuous gases that might surround the moon. There was even a tiny satellite, which Worden would release into lunar orbit in a couple of days, equipped with a magnetometer to stalk the elusive lunar magnetic field. And the 2 cameras were superb creations. One of them, based on declassified spy satellite technology, could photograph details on the surface as small as a yard across. It was just possible, Worden thought, that this enormous haul of data would eclipse the knowledge gained from the rocks his crewmates were collecting down there amid the dust. And to this list of sensing apparatus, add Worden himself, for like Scott and Irwin, he had given himself to the study of the moon. Worden, like Stu Roosa, had made Farouk Elbaz his mentor.
For the first time, a program of visual observations from lunar orbit were an official mission objective. Warden not only admired the exuberant Egyptian, or the king, as the astronauts called him, he liked him as much as he did anyone in the space program and found him an inspiring teacher. After the study sessions, they would go drinking together. "Now," Warden would say, "we're going to see what a white Russian can do to an Egyptian." It would always turn into a competition, and Elbaz would hang in there with a tenacity any fighter pilot would have applauded. It was for the king that Warden spent dozens of hours flying over the mountains and deserts of the western United States, honing his observational skills, and many more hours studying the lunar orbiter photos. And now, in lunar orbit, each time Endeavour flew into sunlight, Warden was amazed to look down and see among the pockmarked chaos a crater he recognized. How strange to be here and see something familiar. No feature was more memorable than giant Tsiolkovsky crater, and for this and other targets, Warden carried photographs with instructions for specific things Elbaz wanted him to watch out for. Looking down on Tsiolkovsky, he could see that it was packed with spectacular geology. The crater was so big that when he was directly overhead, it nearly filled his view. The central peak was enormous, a great white mountain rising out of that floor of dark lava. Warden could see layers in the peak, as if it were a great slab that had somehow been turned on its end. Around it, he spotted boulders that must have been the size of a city block. Along the giant's rim, he could see what appeared to be rock avalanches that had cascaded away from the crater onto the surrounding hummocks. Now he was over a place called Littro, near the Sea of Serenity. Farouk had told him to look very carefully at Littro, because in the unmanned photographs there were craters surrounded by halos of dark material that resembled small volcanoes, or cinder cones, as Farouk called them. If that was true, they might represent an entirely different and possibly much more recent type of volcanic activity from the Maria. Sure enough, Warden could see the small, dark, haloed craters, and he told Capcom Carl Henneis excitedly, "It looks like a whole field of small cinder cones down there." On the next orbit, he would get another look, and he would report the craters were cone-shaped, and that he was even more convinced they were volcanic, and Henneis would say, "Keep talking like that, and we might end up going to Littro sometime." Like anyone who had ever been here before, Warden's mind was split between the operational tasks that filled his consciousness and the sights, sounds, and feelings that were even now being stored in his subconscious. Only during the orbital night did he have time to savor the experience. He had never believed that the solar system was the center of the universe in any sense. In the back of his mind, he'd always thought that the Earth was just one planet among millions. But it wasn't until he found himself over the far side of the moon and saw all those stars, God, there were so many stars, that he was sure there was more to the universe than he had ever imagined. He knew that astronomers had debated the probabilities of intelligent life in the universe, but this light show was enough to convince Warden that it had to be all or nothing. Either there was no life out there, or the cosmos must be teeming with it. Just before emerging from darkness, Warden looked out ahead and saw waves, thin, sinuous bands of light suspended between the starry heavens and the unyielding darkness that was the moon. At first, Warden didn't know what they were. Then he realized he was seeing the rays of the sun, which had not yet risen, glancing off the tops of distant mountains along the horizon. They were the opposite of shadows. The waves thickened until, without warning, night turned almost instantly to day. As his eyes adapted to the light, Warden searched once more among the craters for a familiar place, and for the places he would try to make a little less unknown. Jim Irwin lay in his hammock, awaiting sleep. Before the mission, inspired by the prospect of visiting the lunar mountains, Irwin had felt a desire to hold a short religious observance on the moon, but when he mentioned the idea to his commander, Scott quickly turned him off. But ever since they had arrived on the moon, Irwin felt a spiritual quality about the place. Seemingly insoluble problems had come up, and each time they had been resolved. When he was deploying the ALSEP, he He had a problem that had never happened in training. The cord for deploying the central station broke. Irwin prayed for guidance, and immediately he knew the solution was to get down on his hands and knees and pull the cord manually. Then there was the rover's rear steering, which had been out of commission yesterday, and nothing they did could fix it. Inexplicably, when he and Scott came out this morning, it was working. He felt a glow inside him that whatever problem came up, they would solve it. Once again, Irwin took a moment to pray. He gave thanks that everything was going so well. He gave thanks, too, for the discovery of the white rock, so remarkably displayed on that pedestal of dust, as if it were being presented to them. Tomorrow would surely hold more discoveries, and before he closed his eyes, Irwin prayed that it might also bring him an opportunity to make his own small spiritual gesture. On the moon, a favorite biblical passage, a verse from Psalms, had drifted through his thoughts like a refrain. I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills. From whence cometh my help? My help cometh from the Lord. He hoped that sometime during the next day's activities he would find the right moment to recite it. As he prayed, he sensed that God was near him, even here. 3. The Spirit of Galileo. Joe Allen liked to think he was cut from the same cloth as the pilot astronauts, but working for Dave Scott had been a lesson in humility. The man's stamina was simply amazing. It was beyond him how Scott could go through the long days of meetings and simulations without the slightest sign of wearing down, seemingly as productive and alert at 10 o'clock at night as he had been at breakfast that morning. No question, it did wonders for his motivation to see his boss going at it so relentlessly, but sometimes it was all Allen could do to keep up. He was reminded of the climactic scene from one of his favorite movies, The Hustler. Jackie Gleason as Minnesota Fats, his 24 hours into his pool room confrontation with Paul Newman as Fast Eddie. Just as it seems that Eddie is about to clean the old master out of his last dollar, Fats takes time out. Going into the seedy little bathroom, he washes his face, cleans his fingernails, puts on a fresh shirt and a tie, and emerges into the smoke feeling like a new man. Fast Eddie, he says, let's shoot some pool. Fats goes on to win back all his money and win the match. Allen told Scott about it one day, and after that, when Scott would see him flagging midway through a late evening planning session, he would lean over and say, come on, Joe, let's shoot a little pool. Now, as Scott and Irwin finished suiting up for a final day of exploration, Allen asked Scott if he and Irwin might be ready to shoot a little pool themselves. The answer from the moon, Joe, today's the day for a little pool, now came the endurance lap. Monday, August 2nd, 4:07 a.m., Houston time, 6 days, 19 hours, 32 minutes mission elapsed time. Outside, the first man to spend 3 days on the moon saw the sun almost directly overhead, sending its fierce heat down on Hadley Base. Even within their suits, Scott and Irwin felt its warmth. They had been nearly 2 hours behind schedule getting to sleep last night and waking up this morning, and that had cost them. The liftoff time, slated for later this day, could not be changed. Allen had already told them that this third moonwalk would be shortened to only 4 or 5 hours. Scott and Irwin planned to visit Hadley Rill, and then, if there was time, the mysterious group of craters called the North Complex. A young survey geologist named Jerry Schaber had advanced the idea that the North Complex might actually be a cluster of small volcanoes. Even if they were impact craters, Schaber said, they would still be worth the trip. The largest was almost 2,500 feet across, big enough to have punched through the frosting of Mare basalt and bring up chunks of the more ancient rocks underneath. The North Complex hadn't been on the original Traverse plan, but when Scott heard Schaber's idea, he personally made time for it. Solving that mystery was one of Scott and Irwin's fondest hopes for the mission, but they would have to wait. Allen was sending them to the Alsep site for a showdown with Scott's nemesis, the drill. 4:41 a.m. It was waiting for them when they reached the Alsep, sticking out of the ground just as Scott had left it the day before. When he had tried unsuccessfully to extract the deep core sample, Scott had already begun to wonder whether the core was worth the time and effort it was costing. Fighting their pressurized suits, the men bent over to grab the drill's handles and pulled as hard as they could. The drill did not budge. Scott gave a Herculean pull. 1, 2, 3! And it just barely moved. In mission control, Joe Allen listened with amazement. Scott and Irwin represented as much physical strength as any two men in the astronaut corps. In training, the drill had gone through Texas hardpan like so much butter. It had never caused any problems, going in or coming out. It was, as Scott would say, a nothing. What Allen did not know, what no one knew, was the lunar soil had been so thoroughly compacted and tamped down by eons of micrometeorite rain that there was barely any room for the drill to penetrate. Once driven into the moon, it might as well have been in a vise. "I don't think it's worth doing, Jim," Scott said. "We're not going to get it out." But Irwin wasn't ready to give up. He suggested that each of them hook an arm under one of the handles. That helped. They managed to pull the core about one-third of the way out. Now the men crouched down and each put a shoulder under a handle and tried to stand up. 1, 2, 3! More progress. Another push, then another. They were winning. Suddenly, "There we go!" The drill flew upward, and as Irwin said, we almost flew with it. But Scott's troubles were not over. The entire core sample was 10 feet long. Before they could bring the core home, they would have to dismantle it into sections. And for some unknown reason, the vise from the rover's toolkit refused to work properly. Scott realized with exasperation that it had been assembled backward. No wonder it wouldn't grip. Irwin, meanwhile, broke out a hand wrench. 11 more minutes went by while they struggled to dismantle the sections. Scott's patience was dwindling. Every minute spent on this one sample was time lost for the explorations to come. The trip to the North Complex hung in the balance. "How many hours do you want to spend on this drill, Joe?" Scott wasn't the only one losing patience. For a while now, Allen could hear voices on the flight director's loop from McDivitt and the others in the back row of Mission Control, pushing Flight Director Jerry Griffin to abandon the deep core and get on with the next item on the timeline. Irwin was to take a movie of Scott driving the rover for the engineers, but Griffin, who was fully committed to the science of Apollo 15, wasn't going to be diverted. He understood the value of the deep core, and as the managers pressured him, he walked over to Allen's console and said quietly, "You worry about that core. I'll take care of the back row." On the moon, the struggle continued. Scott and Irwin managed to disassemble the core, but only partially. That would have to do for now. 28 minutes after they began, Allen told them to move on. They'd pick it up on the way back to the LM at the end of the traverse. Scott wasn't sure where they'd put it in the command module, but he'd think of something. That deep core cost too much to leave on the moon. When the deep core was finally scrutinized in the lunar receiving lab, it would teach what geologist Don Wilhelms would call the lesson of the moon's antiquity and changelessness. Scientists would identify no less than 42 separate layers of soil. The bottom layer had apparently remained undisturbed for 500 million years. 5:17 a.m. With the deep core struggle behind them, Scott and Irwin were glad to be heading west toward Hadley Rill. They had expected a short, easy drive, but instead found themselves pitching over dune-like ridges and troughs. Here, Irwin thought, was a place where they could get lost. But even as Falcon disappeared over the horizon behind him, the first time astronauts had ventured out of sight of their lander, Irwin felt no anxiety. So familiar was this valley to him now. Impatient to reach the rill, he urged Scott to take the shortest route, but Scott methodically stuck to the heading Allen had given them, telling Irwin, "We're making good time." As they neared the canyon's edge, Scott's attention was diverted to a small exploration he could not pass up, a small, fresh crater that would prove the youngest ever visited on the moon, a scant 1 million years old. 5:57 a.m. When Scott and Irwin finally stood at the edge of Hadley Rill, they were rewarded with a sight no one had expected. On the far wall, which was in full sunlight, distinct layers of rock poked through a mantle of dust.
like the levels of some ancient civilization. They were surely lava flows. Over many millions of years, perhaps, a succession of outpourings had piled atop one another to build up the valley floor. This was the first and only time that Apollo astronauts would find records of the moon's volcanic life, not as fragments scattered around the rim of an impact crater, but in place, preserved from the day they were formed. This was true lunar bedrock, and there was more of it on this side of the rill. Scott and Irwin gathered their tools and went to work. There was no sharp drop-off at the rim of Hadley Rill. It was more like the gentle shoulder of a hill, and thankfully the ground was firm. Effortlessly, Scott continued past the rim and loped several yards down the slope. Even now he could not see the bottom. It was hidden from view beyond the curved flank. He turned and ascended once more. All around him and Irwin were big slabs of tan-colored basalt, shot through with holes from long vacant gas bubbles. Some of the boulders were scored by layers in miniature, but no sooner had Scott hammered off a chip than Joe Allen passed up word that he and Irwin would have to return to the rover to collect a rake sample, and then it would be time to leave. On another day, Scott might have put up a fight. Today he was too tired. But in the back room, the geologists decided that the rill was worth more time. Urgently, Scott called Irwin to join him a little farther down the slope, where masses of darker rock waited. As they set to work, the men heard Joe Allen's voice once more. Out of sheer curiosity, how far back from the edge of the rill are the two of you standing now? Scott wasn't sure what he meant until Allen clarified it. It looks like the two of you are standing on the edge of a precipice. Scott managed to suppress a laugh. He could just imagine the back row of mission control. McDivitt, Kraft, Petroni, and the others tied up in knots, their worst nightmare splashed on the big screen and multiplied on every TV monitor, because it looked like their boys on the moon were about to wander over the edge of a cliff. Oh, gosh, no, Scott reassured. It slopes right on down here. The extension amounted to all of 8 minutes. Enough time to gather a few more samples. Scott and Irwin headed back to the rover, wishing, once again, that they had more time. One thing was still true, and it would be true throughout the Apollo era. Those on Earth who carried the burden of responsibility for human lives would greet each new exploration with apprehension, while the men on the moon, confident and committed in their work, wanted only to push a little bit farther. 7:56 a.m. Back at Hadley Base, rover tracks converged on the foil-clad lunar module, and the ground was littered with gear and stowage bags attesting to the activity of the past 3 days. Beyond, the Apennines were bathed in sunlight, their slopes seemingly as soft and virginal as a meadow after a fresh snowfall. On the drive back, gazing at them, Jim Irwin had finally quoted the words of the psalmist. But there had been no time for the North Complex. They would not solve that mystery after all. For all that they had accomplished, that loss was hard to take. Irwin felt their explorations were only half finished. But right now, the most important thing was to get back into the LM with plenty of time to prepare for liftoff. When everything was all packed up, Scott attended to a task that wasn't on the checklist. He had thought he might not get to it, but it was Joe Allen's idea, and he didn't want to disappoint him. He reached into a pocket on his suit and pulled out a falcon feather. Then, picking up his geology hammer, he loped back to where the rover was parked and stood before the TV camera. In my left hand, I have a feather. In my right hand, a hammer. Centuries before, the story was told, Galileo Galilei had stood atop the Leaning Tower of Pisa and dropped two weights of different sizes, proving that gravity acts equally on all objects regardless of their mass. And where would be a better place to confirm his findings, Scott said, than on the moon? He held the hammer and the feather out in front of him and let go. They fell slowly through the vacuum, side by side, and for one brief moment the spirit of the great Italian scientist was conjured on the airless ground of Hadley Base. When the hammer and the feather hit the dust at the same time, there was applause in mission control. Nothing like a little science on the moon, Scott said. 8:08 a.m. Alone,
Scott drove Rover 1 to a small rise about 300 feet east of Falcon. From here, Mission Control would be able to aim the TV camera back at the LM and watch the liftoff 4 hours from now. Scott made some final switch settings and then, before he headed back, he pulled out a small red Bible and set it atop the rover's control panel. If anyone should come this way again, he wanted them to understand who had left this machine here. Then he walked about 20 feet until he came to a small, subtle crater, reached down, and made a hollow in the dust. Into it he placed a small plaque bearing the names of 14 men. The previous winter, at a New Year's party at Deke Slayton's house, Scott and Slayton had shared the hope that no more astronauts would ever be lost to the cause of space exploration. Scott resolved that he would find a way to memorialize those who had already been killed. Maybe then no more would die. He had never met some of the men remembered on this plaque, including the 3 cosmonauts of Soyuz 11. Others he had called friends. Next to the plaque, he placed a small aluminum figure, a stylized representation of a fallen astronaut. Scott paused to take one last series of panoramic photos. Then, casting his eyes on the high slopes of a peak just to the south of Mount Hadley, he saw what looked like layers, and automatically began to describe them for the geologists. But Joe Allen cut him off. There wasn't time. Scott took off in long, easy strides, heading across the rolling plains toward his lunar module. He could not deny a sense of loss, knowing that he would never return to this ultimate field site. But just now, Joe Allen was quoting the science fiction author Robert Heinlein, "We're ready for you to come again to the homes of men on the cool, green hills of Earth." Scott felt the chin strap of his communications carrier rasp against a week-old beard. He'd promised his children he wouldn't shave until he got home. After all, explorers always come home with a beard. 4. The Final Selection. The first thing Jim Irwin did when he climbed into the life raft was dip his hand into the cool water of the Pacific and bring it to his face. He wore no respirator. There was no quarantine trailer waiting for him and his crewmates on the carrier Okinawa. 3 landing crews had returned to Earth healthy. Not a trace of anything alive had turned up in the samples, and at last NASA could do away with quarantine without risking any political heat, and Irwin was very glad of that. To arrive from the dust of Hadley to the blue Pacific was the most wonderful sensation he could have imagined. He wanted only to let the sea air wash over him and the morning sun fill him with warmth. He would have stayed there in that raft, but all too soon he heard the roar of the helicopter about 50 feet above him and felt its wind. The recovery people lowered the net for him. Irwin climbed into it and ascended from the water back into the sky. Aboard the helicopter, Irwin tried to come up with something to say when he arrived on the carrier deck. Dave Scott reminded him and Worden that when they stepped out of the helicopter, they should all salute in unison. They had talked about this before. Irwin remembered, Scott didn't like the fact that the other crews hadn't saluted together. On this flight, they were going to salute like military officers. Suddenly they were landing, and when the door opened, Scott was out first, and when he stood on the stairway, he saluted immediately, without waiting for them. On the carrier deck, Irwin felt unsteady and realized he hadn't cleared his ears in the command module on the way down, but those last 5 minutes had been the most hectic of the entire flight. One of the 3 parachutes had collapsed as soon as it was deployed, and the craft had descended faster than normal. On the way down, Irwin had seen them have a near miss with a helicopter. They'd hit the water with a solid impact, but everything was all right. When it was his turn at the microphone, Irwin expressed gratitude for the trip and to everyone on Earth who supported them. He had been trained at the Naval Academy, he said, and he'd been on ships before, but he'd never been so glad to be on one as he was right now. During the night, Irwin slept fitfully. As he lay flat in his bunk, he felt as if his body were tilted heads down at a steep angle. At 5 in the morning, he awoke to the din of the anchor chains up on the deck. Not long afterward, he and his crewmates were getting the hero's welcome at Hickam Air Force Base in Hawaii. By mid-morning, they were airborne again, inside a big transport headed for Texas. They were strangely isolated in their small compartment, as if everyone were avoiding them, as if they weren't sure ending the quarantine was such a good idea after all. Probably it was just as well, because no sooner had the C-140 lumbered off the runway at Hickam than Scott pulled out a stack of first-day covers for them to sign. He had carried them on the flight in his pocket of his spacesuit. The covers were part of a deal with a stamp dealer who had approached Scott during training. Eventually, some of them would be sold in order to set up trust funds for their children. Before the flight, Irwin had harbored reservations about the deal, but had decided not to say anything to Scott for fear of causing friction with his commander. Irwin sat in silence, signing the envelopes and assembling in his mind the experiences of his 12 days in space. He thought of the wonderful mental clarity he'd had on the moon, the powerful sense of God's nearness. He thought of the discovery of the white rock. He could not imagine how his crewmates might have been affected, but here in this small cabin, he knew his soul had been stirred. He was a nuts and bolts man who had come back with something he had never anticipated, the seed of spiritual awakening. And when he was back home in Nassau Bay, he found joy in the most ordinary things, just to sit in a chair, to eat at a table without having to chase food into his mouth, the reassuring sense of up and down. He had a new appreciation for all these things. Life itself was cause for celebration. Irwin felt so renewed that he wondered if he'd discovered a cure for despondency, for those who have lost their appetite for life. Lock them up for a while, deprive them of all earthly experience, and then let them out into the world again. But physically, Irwin wasn't quite right. He was still having difficulty adjusting to the pull of gravity, including some bouts of dizziness. He wasn't doing very well on the stress tests and the medical physicals, and the doctors had told him that during the flight, after he and Scott had returned to the command module, he'd had a problem with his heart. At the time, Irwin had no idea anything was wrong. He knew only that he was suddenly very tired. Unbeknownst to him, the doctors watching his EKG in mission control were alarmed to see a so-called bigeminal rhythm, in which each normal heartbeat is followed by an extra beat. Houston never said anything about it, nor about the fact that both he and Scott had also experienced minor heart irregularities during their time on the lunar surface. Both men were angry that no one from Chuck Berry's staff had informed them while they were in space. Now, on Earth, the doctors were ascribing the problems to the rigors of training. During practice sessions for the moonwalks, Scott and Irwin had spent hours working in spacesuits in intense summer heat. To replenish lost fluids, they drank large amounts of an electrolyte solution which tended to leach potassium from their systems. As a result, the doctors would conclude, they left Earth with a potassium deficiency that was exacerbated by the stress of the mission, causing their subsequent heart irregularities. Irwin hoped that soon he would be back to normal. Dave Scott was also tired, though not as much as his lunar module pilot. He wished he and his crew could have been locked up along with the moon rocks in the lunar receiving laboratory. He wanted nothing more than to be put away for 3 weeks, with time to rest and write the mission reports and talk to the scientists. He would have loved to have time to look at the videotapes of the moonwalks and study the rocks with geologists. There wouldn't have been any pressure from the home front to get him back quickly. It would have been fine with Lurton. Before the mission, he'd pushed hard for it, but not hard enough. Instead, he was let out into the world for long days of debriefings. In his free moments, he found himself signing photographs. It seemed that every general in the Air Force wanted one autographed specially for him. And at night, it was the time of the neighborhood party. Scott would have enjoyed it much more if he hadn't been so worn out. And still to come, there was the trip to Washington, the speeches before Congress, then to New York and Los Angeles for talk shows and parades. A month after splashdown, instead of savoring the accomplishment, he would be completely exhausted. To Al Worden, the debriefings were interminable. Day after day, they rehashed the mission for the engineers, and then the operations people, and then the managers. By the second week of answering